A bundle of freshly cut firewood slipped from an old woman's trembling arms and crashed onto the muddy roadside, just as a horse-drawn carriage rolled to a halt. Travelers turned away. Merchants pretended not to notice. Even those with empty hands hurried past, afraid the delay would cost them precious time. Then, Clara stepped quietly out of the crowd, knelt in the mud without hesitation, and lifted the heaviest piece onto her own shoulder before reaching for the rest. The old woman warned her that the load was far too much for one person, yet Clara only smiled and asked which road led home. She never asked for payment. She never asked who the old woman was. She simply carried the crushing weight, as though kindness was worth more than comfort. But hidden beneath a weathered shawl, the old woman's eyes held a secret that could change both their lives forever. Someone else, who was the Duke, was watching from a distance, and before the sun set, every choice made on that lonely road would be judged by the most powerful man in the county. Now tell me, if you were walking that same road, would you have stopped to help, or would you have kept going? Share your answer in the comments and tell us which beautiful part of the world you are watching from. If you enjoy heartfelt historical stories filled with unforgettable twists, remember to subscribe so you never miss the next one. You may think you already know what happens after Clara lifted that burden, but I have a feeling your guess will not survive what comes next. Clara had not planned to walk that road at all. Her original path cut through the east side of Dunmore Village, past the butcher's stall, and the narrow alley that smelled of salted meat and wet stone. It was faster, familiar, and it kept her away from the crowded market lane, where noise and delay were guaranteed before 9 in the morning. But the east path had flooded overnight, and so she found herself on the main road with her basket on her arm, and her patience already thinning before the day had properly begun. She was the second daughter of a country physician, Dr. Arthur Bain, a man respected in Dunmore for his steady hands and gentle manner, but not wealthy by any honest measure. Clara had grown up understanding the difference between dignity and comfort. They had the first. The second came and went, depending on the season, and how many of her father's patients remembered to pay him. That morning, she was heading to the linen merchant on behalf of her mother, a quiet and careful woman named Frances Bain, who had written the list twice to make sure nothing was forgotten. Clara was halfway through mentally reviewing that list when she heard the crash. The sound was sharp and immediate, a heavy wooden bundle striking wet ground with the kind of force that made nearby horses flinch. She turned without thinking. An old woman stood at the edge of the road, both arms stretched forward and empty, staring down at the scattered firewood around her feet as though she could not quite believe what had just happened. Her shawl was pulled low over her head, her back curved with age, and her breathing came in short, visible bursts in the cold morning air. Nobody moved. A carriage had stopped a few feet away, not out of concern, but simply because the road was partially blocked. The driver looked irritated. Two merchants standing nearby exchanged a glance, and then looked away with practiced efficiency. A young boy carrying a bread tray stepped around the scattered wood as though it were nothing more than an inconvenience in his path. The old woman bent forward to reach for the nearest piece and immediately straightened again. One hand pressing against the side of her back, her face tight with pain, she was too proud to announce. Clara set her basket down against a wall post and walked over. She did not announce herself, or ask permission, or wait for an invitation. She simply crouched beside the wood, began gathering the pieces back into the carry cloth, and worked quickly because the ground was wet and the wood was getting heavier, with every passing second it sat in the mud. The old woman looked down at her with an expression that moved through surprise, suspicion, and something softer, all within the space of a few heartbeats. "You will ruin your dress," the old woman said, her voice low and slightly hoarse. "It has survived worse," Clara replied without looking up. She tied the carry cloth the way her father had taught her to secure heavy bundles for transport, a firm double knot with the ends tucked inward so the weight distributed evenly across whoever was carrying it. Then she lifted the bundle onto her own shoulder, straightened her back against the pull of it, and turned to the old woman with a steady look. "Which road leads to your home?" The old woman studied her for a moment longer than felt comfortable. Her eyes were sharp beneath the low edge of her shawl, and Clara had the distinct and slightly unsettling feeling that she was being measured rather than simply looked at. Then the old woman pointed down the road that curved west, away from the market, and toward the quieter edges of Dunmore, where the houses grew further apart and the trees grew closer together. They walked. Clara did not fill the silence with unnecessary conversation. She asked once if the pace was comfortable, adjusted her grip on the bundle when her shoulder began to protest, and watched the road ahead for puddles deep enough to cause trouble. The old woman walked slowly but steadily, and after a while she spoke again. "What is your name, child?" "Clara Bain. My father is Dr. Arthur Bain on Ferrers Lane." The old woman made a small sound that could have been recognition or simply acknowledgement. "And does Dr. Bain's daughter make a habit of carrying strangers' firewood through the mud?" "Only when nobody else will," Clara said, and she meant it without any sharpness, simply as a statement of fact. What she did not know was that those six words had just been heard by someone other than the old woman. The Duke was standing far enough back that a casual glance down the road would not have found him. He was not dressed in a way that announced anything remarkable about him. A long coat, plain riding boots, the kind of quiet clothing that men of significant means sometimes chose deliberately when they did not want to be recognized. His name was William Arden, the Duke of Merrith, and he had been in Dunmore for exactly 4 days under the thin pretense of inspecting a land boundary dispute that his steward could have handled without him. The truth was more complicated and considerably less administrative. Standing beside him was his closest companion and adviser, a sharp-eyed man named Charles Pell. It was Charles who had suggested the woman. It was Charles who had arranged for Agnes, the Duke's elderly housekeeper, to be on that road with that bundle at that precise hour. And it was Charles who now stood quietly beside the Duke and waited to see what the man would say. William said nothing for a long moment. He watched Clara shift the bundle higher on her shoulder when it began to slip. He watched her say something to the old woman that made Agnes, who was not actually named Agnes in any ordinary sense, but who served the Duke's household with complete devotion, slow her steps and respond with something that looked almost like a smile. He watched Clara navigate a wide puddle by stepping to the very edge of the road, making sure the old woman had the drier ground to walk on. "She did not hesitate," William said finally, his voice quiet enough that only Charles could hear it. "No," Charles agreed. "She did not. And she has no idea who the woman is." "None whatsoever." William was quiet again for another moment. Then he turned away from the road and walked back toward the inn where his horses were stabled, his hands clasped behind his back, and his expression giving away absolutely nothing. But Charles had known this man for 15 years, and he noticed the way the Duke's pace had slowed just slightly, the way his eyes had stayed on the road a half second longer than necessary before he turned. Charles filed that detail away carefully and said nothing about it. Back on the road, Clara had no idea she had just passed a test she did not know she was taking. She was thinking about her mother's linen list and wondering whether the wood was heavier than it looked, or whether her shoulder was simply weaker than she wanted to admit. She was also thinking, with mild irritation, that her hem was definitely ruined, and that Frances Bane would notice it the moment she walked through the door. The old woman stopped outside a modest stone cottage set back from the road behind a low garden wall. It was neat and well kept, with small, carefully tended beds along the front path that spoke of someone who took quiet pride in order. Clara set the bundle down beside the gate and worked the knot open so the wood could be stacked properly. "You could leave it there," the old woman said. "It will be easier stacked," Clara replied, already beginning. The old woman watched her without speaking. Then, after a while, she said, "Will you come inside for something warm before you go back?" Clara looked at the sky, calculated how long she had already been delayed, thought briefly about the linen list, and then looked at the old woman's face, where something careful and searching still lived behind the polite offer. "Just for a moment," Clara said. She did not know that the moment would cost her everything she thought she understood about her own future. The inside of the cottage was warmer than Clara expected, and tidier than most houses twice its size. A fire burned low in the grate, and the furniture, though simple, was arranged with a precision that felt almost deliberate, as though every chair and table had been placed to serve a purpose beyond comfort. Clara noticed a writing desk in the corner with a stack of correspondence that looked recently attended to, and a small framed miniature on the mantel that she did not look at long enough to identify. She set her basket near the door and accepted the chair closest to the fire, because the cold had worked its way into her shoulder during the walk, and she was trying not to show it. The old woman moved around the small kitchen space with more ease than her performance on the road had suggested, and Clara filed that observation away without comment. She was not suspicious exactly. She was simply paying attention, the way her father had taught her to read a room before she read a patient. "You noticed," the old woman said, without turning from the fire. Clara looked up. "I noticed you moved differently once we arrived. And yet you said nothing." "It was not my place to say anything," Clara replied. "You did not ask for my opinion of how you walk." The old woman turned then and looked at her with those sharp, unhurried eyes again. "Most young women your age would have demanded an explanation, or felt foolish for having been deceived." "I was not deceived," Clara said simply. "I helped someone who appeared to need it. Whether the need was precisely as it appeared is a separate matter entirely." She set a cup of something hot on the small table beside Clara's chair, and then sat down, across from her with the careful movements. Her name, she offered then, without being asked, was Dorothea. She did not offer a surname, and Clara did not request one. "My employer," Dorothea began, folding her hands in her lap, "has been in Dunmore for several days." Clara waited. "He is not here for the reasons the village believes he is here for," Dorothea continued. "The boundary matter is real enough, but it is not what keeps him here, past the time it would take a man of his resources to resolve it." "And why are you telling me this?" Clara asked. "Because he sent me out this morning," Dorothea said, with a calm directness that landed heavier than any dramatic announcement could have. "And you were the only person on that road who stopped." The fire crackled between them. Clara looked at the cup in her hands, and then back at Dorothea, with an expression that was careful and very still. "Who is your employer?" she asked. Dorothea told her. The name William Arden meant something in this county. It meant something in most counties, if one was being accurate about it. The Duke of Nereth held land that stretched further than most men could ride in a day, sat in Lords when Parliament was in session, and had been the subject of more pointed speculation in drawing rooms across the region than Clara cared to remember, overhearing at her neighbours' dinner tables. He was also, by every account she had encountered, completely unmarried, extraordinarily private, and not known for spending his time in small market towns without very specific reason. Clara set the cup down. "He was watching," she said. It was not a question. "From the moment the wood fell," Dorothea confirmed. Clara sat with that for several seconds. "And if I had walked past," she asked. "Then I would have picked up my own firewood," Dorothea said, "and you would never have sat in this chair, and nothing further would have come of it." "But I did not walk past." "No," Dorothea said. "You did not." Clara stood and moved to the window. The road outside was quiet now, the morning crowd thinned to a few slow walkers and a cart moving toward the mill. She looked at the garden wall and the neat beds along the path and thought about a man standing in the shadows of a market lane, watching to see what a stranger would do when nobody was requiring her to do anything at all. "What does he want?" she asked, still looking at the window. "He has not said specifically," Dorothea replied. "But he has asked that I extend an invitation." Clara turned. "His household is hosting a small dinner this Friday evening at Harwick Hall, where he is staying as a guest of Lord Fenmore. He would like you to attend." Harwick Hall was the grandest private residence within 12 miles of Dunmore. And Lord Fenmore was the kind of man whose invitations arrived on thick paper with wax seals and were discussed for weeks afterward by anyone fortunate enough to receive one. Clara had never been inside its gates. She had walked past them once with her father and looked through the ironwork at the long gravel drive and the pale stone face of the building beyond. "Why?" Clara asked, and she meant it genuinely. She was not being modest. She was a physician's daughter with a ruined hem and a linen list in her basket. The question was entirely reasonable. "Because," Dorothea said, with a patience that suggested she had been asked harder questions by more difficult people, "a man in his position spends a great deal of time in rooms full of people who want something from him. This morning was the first time in longer than I can tell you that he watched someone do something without wanting anything at all." Clara looked at her for a long moment. Then she picked up her basket, straightened her coat, and told Dorothea she would need to think about it. She walked back out through the neat garden, past the stacked firewood beside the gate, and onto the road toward the linen merchant. She did not look back, but her mind was already turning the morning over and examining it from every angle, the way it does when something has happened that cannot be simply filed away and forgotten. By the time she reached the merchant's door, she had made her decision. She just had not admitted it to herself yet. Meanwhile, Charles Pell found the Duke exactly where he expected to find him, standing at the window of his borrowed study at Harwick Hall with a cup of untouched tea going cold on the desk behind him. "Well?" William said, without turning. "She stayed for a cup of something warm," Charles reported. "She asked the right questions. She did not perform surprise or outrage, and she left without giving Dorothea a firm answer." William turned from the window then. His face was unreadable in the way that came from years of practice rather than indifference. "She will come," he said. Charles raised an eyebrow. "You sound certain for a man who has not exchanged a single word with her." "I watched her tie a carry knot in wet weather without being asked, and navigate a puddle so an old woman could have the dry ground," William said. "She will come because she is curious, and she strikes me as someone who does not easily tolerate unanswered questions. Charles said nothing for a moment. Then, very carefully, he picked up a pen from the desk and made a note in the small book he carried everywhere. "Shall I arrange the seating accordingly?" he asked. William had already turned back to the window. "Yes," he said. "And tell Lord Fenmore we will need one additional place at the table." The invitation arrived at the Bain household the following morning before breakfast. Clara was the one who answered the door, still holding a piece of bread she had not yet eaten, and the man who handed her the folded paper was dressed in the kind of quiet livery that announced serious employment without trying to impress anyone. He did not wait for a response. He simply delivered it and left, and Clara stood in the doorway reading her own name, written in a hand so precise it looked almost architectural. Francis Bain appeared at her shoulder within seconds, drawn by the sound of the door and the instinct of a woman who had spent 20 years quietly monitoring everything that happened under her roof. She read the invitation over Clara's arm and said nothing for a moment that stretched longer than comfortable. "Harwick Hall," Francis said finally. "Yes," Clara said. "Lord Fenmore's table." "So it appears." Francis took the paper from Clara's hand, read it again from the beginning, as though the second reading might change something, and then looked at her daughter. "Your father will want to know about this," she said. Dr. Arthur Bain was a measured man who did not excite easily, but when he read the invitation at the breakfast table with his spectacles pushed to the end of his nose, something moved behind his eyes that Clara recognized as concern, dressed in the clothing of careful thought. "A duke," he said. "A duke's housekeeper," Clara corrected. "It was his housekeeper who I helped. He was watching." "That is not a reassuring clarification," Arthur said. "I did not do anything wrong," Clara said, quietly but firmly. "I helped someone carry firewood. That is the entirety of what happened." Arthur looked at his wife. Francis looked at the invitation. There was a full silent conversation between them that Clara could not entirely follow, which was irritating because she was 23 years old and felt she had earned the right to follow her parents' silent conversations by now. "You may go," Arthur said at last. "But I will speak to Mrs. Hargrove about accompanying you." Mrs. Hargrove was their neighbor, a widow of respectable standing who had attended enough formal dinners in her time to navigate the social geometry of a table like Lord Fenmore's without embarrassing anyone. Clara accepted this condition without argument, because it was reasonable, and because she had already decided she was going regardless of what conditions attached themselves to the decision. What nobody at that breakfast table knew was that across the village, in a parlor above a hat shop on the main street, a different conversation was taking place about the very same invitation. Her name was Lavinia Croft, and she was the eldest daughter of a wealthy landowner named Gerald Croft, whose property bordered the western edge of Lord Fenmore's estate. Lavinia was beautiful in the way that announces itself immediately upon entering a room, and then spends the rest of the evening reminding everyone of the fact. She had been angling toward the Duke of Merrith since the first whisper of his presence in Dunmore reached her ears, and she had done so with the focused patience of someone who understood that positioning was everything and timing was the rest. She had expected an invitation to Friday's dinner. She had received one, which made the news she was now hearing from her lady's maid all the more interesting and all the more threatening. "Clara Bain," Lavinia repeated, her voice perfectly level, in the way that very controlled people keep their voices level when they are actually furious. "The physician's daughter." "Yes, miss," said the maid, whose name was Polly, and who had learned to deliver difficult information with her eyes slightly averted. "She helped an old woman carry firewood," Lavinia said, as though arranging the facts in a line so she could examine each one individually. That is what they are saying in the market. And now she is invited to dine at Harwick Hall. Polly said nothing, which was the wisest available response. Lavinia stood at her window and looked out at the main road below, with an expression that was entirely pleasant on the surface, and entirely calculated beneath it. She was not a foolish woman. She understood immediately what the invitation meant, even if the village at large had not yet assembled the pieces. The Duke had not invited Clara Bain out of charity or general goodwill. He had invited her because he had been watching and had decided she was worth a closer look. That was a problem Lavinia intended to solve before Friday evening. She turned from the window and sat at her writing desk with the brisk efficiency of someone who had made a decision and was already three steps into executing it. She wrote two notes. The first went to a woman named Mrs. Stanton, who was Lord Fenmore's housekeeper and who owed Lavinia's father a social favor of sufficient size that it could be reasonably called in without negotiation. The second note went to a young man named Philip Croft, her younger brother, who was exactly the kind of person who enjoyed causing precise, well-timed trouble and never asked too many questions about why. She sealed both notes, handed them to Polly, and went back to her window with the calm face of someone who had already won an argument that had not yet begun. Clara knew nothing of any of this. She spent Thursday helping her father with his afternoon rounds, carrying his bag along the familiar lanes of Dunmore while he called on patients, and she waited outside, watching the sky shift through a thin, grey afternoon. She thought about the dinner. She thought about William Arden. She had asked around carefully about him. What she gathered was consistent and somewhat contradictory. He was said to be fair but demanding, private but not cold. He had run his estates without scandal, which in this county was considered a significant achievement. He had been briefly engaged 3 years ago to a woman from a northern family, and the engagement had ended quietly enough that the specific reason remained genuinely unclear. She also heard from her father's oldest patient, a retired magistrate named Mr. Hartley, who knew more about more people than anyone Clara had ever met, that William Arden had arrived in Dunmore with a companion and an agenda that went beyond any boundary dispute, and that Lord Fenmore himself had seemed surprised by the length of the Duke's stay. That last detail she found genuinely interesting. Friday arrived with cold, clear air, and a sky so pale it looked like the colour had been carefully drained from it overnight. Clara dressed without ceremony, pinned her hair with the pearl clips her grandmother had left her. She walked inside the carriage and listened to Mrs. Hargrove talk for the entire ride about the correct way to address a duke at a dinner table, which apparently involved a specific angle of attention that Clara was fairly certain she would forget the moment she needed it. Harwick Hall was exactly as imposing as she remembered from the outside, and considerably more so from the inside. The entrance hall alone was large enough to contain the entire ground floor of the Bain house, with high ceilings and a staircase that curved upward with the kind of confidence that only old money expressed without effort. A butler named Greaves received them at the door with a practiced warmth. There were eight at the table that evening. Lord Fenmore sat at its head, a broad and genial man in his 60s, who laughed easily and meant it. Beside him sat his wife, Harriet Fenmore, a small, sharp woman who missed nothing and filed everything. There was a Sir Robert Alcott and his wife Margaret, landowners from two counties east, and a younger man introduced as Thomas Vell, who was apparently attached to some governmental function that was described vaguely enough that Clara suspected it was intended to sound more significant than it was. Mrs. Hargrove was seated comfortably between Sir Robert and Lady Fenmore, which Clara was grateful for, because it meant she would be occupied and unavailable to monitor Clara's angle of attention. And then there was Lavinia Croft, seated directly across the table, looking exactly as composed and precisely positioned as Clara would have predicted if she had known to predict anything at all. Clara did not know Lavinia well. Their paths crossed occasionally, in the way that paths cross in a small county, between people of different but proximate social standing. She knew the name, knew the family, knew the face well enough to recognize it. What she did not know, as she took her seat and unfolded her napkin, was that Lavinia had spent the last 2 days specifically arranging the circumstances of this evening. William Arden entered the room last, which was not quite custom, but was the kind of thing nobody corrected when the person doing it held a dukedom. He was taller than Clara had imagined from Dorothea's description, broad across the shoulder, with dark hair and a face that was not quite handsome. He had a beard, close and neat, and he moved through the room with the absolute, unhurried confidence of someone who had never once needed to announce himself. His eyes found Clara within the first 10 seconds of entering the room. She noticed, and immediately looked at her water glass. Charles Pell entered behind him, took a seat near the end of the table with his small notebook, nowhere visible but almost certainly somewhere close, and began talking quietly to Thomas Fell about something. Dinner began. The food was excellent. The conversation moved the way conversation moves at tables where everyone is too intelligent to talk about anything directly. Lord Fenmore asked William about the boundary matter, with the comfortable familiarity of a man who already knew the answer. Lady Fenmore asked Clara about her father, with a genuine warmth that suggested she had either met Arthur Bayne before or done some preparation before the evening. Lavinia spoke about the county's upcoming assembly. Clara watched all of it and said what was appropriate when it was appropriate, and tried not to look across the table at William Arden more than was reasonable. She failed at the last part approximately 4 times before the second course arrived. He was watching her, she knew that. Then Lavinia said something that changed the entire texture of the evening. She said it sweetly, with a smile that was completely convincing to anyone who was not paying close attention. She addressed it to Lady Fenmore, but she pitched her voice at the precise volume required to reach the whole table. I did hear the most charming story about someone helping an old woman on the market road this week, Lavinia said. It reminded me of something one reads in a moral tale for children. So pure and uncomplicated. Exactly the sort of impulse one expects from someone entirely unacquainted with how the world actually works. The table did not stop. Conversations continued. Cutlery moved against china. But something shifted in the air above the table with the subtle violence of a pressure change before a storm, and Clara felt it land precisely where Lavinia had aimed it. She looked up from her plate. Lavinia was already looking at her, smiling, perfectly pleasant, perfectly deliberate. Clara set her fork down with a care that had nothing to do with the fork. She looked at Lavinia across the table, the way her father had taught her to look at a difficult situation. Not with heat. Not with retreat. But with steadiness. I think, Clara said, with a calm that surprised even herself, that understanding how the world works and choosing how to behave in it are two entirely separate things. Most people I admire have managed to learn the difference. The table registered this. Lady Fenmore's expression shifted by a fraction that meant approval. Lord Fenmore cleared his throat pleasantly and reached for his glass. Mrs. Hargrove, to her credit, continued eating with the serenity of a woman who had witnessed far worse at far grander tables. Lavinia smiled wider, which was itself an answer. William Arden said nothing. But Clara, who was now paying extremely close attention to things she probably should not have been paying attention to, noticed that he set his own glass down with a very slight pause, and that his eyes moved from Lavinia to Clara, and then back to his plate. Charles Pell wrote something in a small notebook. The dinner continued, but it had become a different dinner than the one it had been before Lavinia spoke. Lavinia, for her part, did not press further. She was far too intelligent for that. She had planted what she intended to plant, and was content to let it grow in whatever direction it chose. She spoke to Sir Robert about horses, and to Lady Fenmore about gardens, and was by every measure the most effortlessly charming person at the table for the remainder of the meal. But after dinner, when the party separated in the way that parties separate in large houses, men to one room and women to another, Clara found herself standing near the tall windows of Lady Fenmore's sitting room, looking out at the dark grounds and thinking about the precise calculation behind Lavinia's comment. It had been aimed to diminish, to reframe Clara's action on the road as naivety rather than character, to suggest to a man who valued intelligence that the woman he had been watching was simply innocent of the world rather than genuinely good within it. It was a clever move. Clara could see it clearly. What she had not anticipated was the knock at the door. Greaves appeared and addressed Lady Fenmore with the specific gravity of a man delivering a message that had been carefully considered before sending. His Grace, he reported, had asked whether Miss Bayne might have a moment to speak with him briefly in the portrait corridor before the evening concluded, with Lady Fenmore's blessing, of course, and in full view of the open corridor, which Greaves managed to communicate as a reassurance without making it sound like one. Lady Fenmore looked at Clara with an expression that was entirely readable and entirely kind. "The portrait corridor is perfectly public," she said simply. "You may go if you wish." Clara went. The portrait corridor ran along the east wing of Harwick Hall, and was exactly what the name promised. A long, straight passage hung with large, formal paintings of the Fenmore family across three generations, lit by lamps spaced at intervals that created more shadow than light between them. William was standing at the far end when Clara entered, looking up at a portrait of a severe-looking man on horseback with the focused attention of someone who was not actually thinking about the painting at all. He heard her approach and turned. Up close, he was more difficult to read than she expected, and more immediately present than she had prepared herself for. "Miss Bayne," he said. "Your Grace," she replied. A pause, the kind that is not empty, but that neither person rushes to fill. "I owe you an explanation," he said. "You do not owe me anything," Clara said. "Though I will admit to finding the situation considerably more interesting than my original Friday evening plans." "What were your original plans?" "Reviewing my father's patient notes and arguing with my mother about whether the parlor curtains need replacing," Clara said. "So you can understand why I accepted." This time it was an actual smile, brief but genuine. Clara noted this and moved on before she could spend more time than was sensible thinking about it. "Why did you do it?" she asked directly, because she had decided on the walk down the corridor that she was not going to circle around the actual subject for the sake of politeness. "The test. Dorothea, on the road." He was quiet for a moment. "I have been in the process," he said carefully, "of trying to understand whether my judgment of people can still be trusted." Clara looked at him steadily. "What happened to it?" "A person I trusted entirely," he said, "turned out to be trustworthy in every area except the one that mattered most." He did not elaborate, and she did not push, but she understood. "And you thought watching a stranger on a muddy road would restore your confidence in your own judgment, Clara said. I thought it would tell me something true, he said, without any of the variables that come with introduction and intention and social performance. And did it? He looked at her for a moment that had weight to it. You are here, he said simply. Clara looked at the portrait on the wall beside them, a young woman in formal dress with a composed expression that gave nothing away, and thought about what it meant to be tested by someone who needed proof that goodness existed and was not simply clever disguise. I should tell you, she said, that I do not intend to behave differently now that I know I was being watched. So if the version of me you observed on that road is the version you were hoping to see more of, the good news is that there is only one version. He was quiet for several seconds. That, he said, is exactly what I was hoping you would say. Then we are off to an honest start, Clara said. She excused herself before the conversation could settle into something she was not ready to name, walked back down the portrait corridor at a pace that was composed and unhurried, and did not allow herself to exhale properly until she was back in the warmth of Lady Fenmore's sitting room, with Mrs. Hargrove talking cheerfully at her from across the tea tray. What she did not see was Philip Croft, Lavinia's brother, slipping out of a side door near the end of the portrait corridor, having listened to every single word from the shadow of an alcove 10 feet away. And what she did not know was that Philip had a very good memory, and a sister who would put every word he reported to deliberate, calculated use. By morning, the shape of the evening had already begun to change in ways that Clara would not fully understand until it was considerably harder to undo them. Philip Croft delivered his report before the morning fire had properly caught. Lavinia listened without interrupting. When Philip finished, she was quiet for exactly the length of time it took her to decide what the information was worth and what she intended to do with it. He told her she was here because he watched her on the road, Philip summarized, helping himself to the breakfast tray without being invited. She told him there is only one version of herself. He looked at her like she had said something remarkable. She did say something remarkable, Lavinia said, which surprised Philip enough that he stopped chewing. That is precisely the problem. She stood and moved to the window. Outside, Dunmore was beginning its ordinary morning, carts and cold air and people with somewhere to be. Lavinia watched it without seeing any of it. The situation was cleaner in her head now than it had been the previous evening. The Duke was not simply curious about Clara Bain. He was drawn to her. This required a different approach entirely. I need you to speak to Polly, she told Philip. And I need it done before the week is out. Philip frowned. Polly the maid. What has she got to do with anything? She has a cousin, Lavinia said, who works at the inn where Charles Pell has been staying, and Charles Pell writes everything down. Philip looked at his sister for a moment with the expression of someone who has just remembered, again, that she is several steps ahead of him at all times. You want his notebook? Philip said. I want to know what is in it, Lavinia corrected. There is a difference. Across the village, Clara was in her father's study, telling him about the evening. She told him about dinner, about Lady Fenmore's warmth, about the general atmosphere of the evening. She did not tell him about the portrait corridor. She told herself this was because it would require more explanation than the morning had time for, and she almost believed it. Arthur Bain listened with his hands folded on his desk and his eyes on his daughter's face, with the particular attention of a man who has spent decades reading what people are not saying. And the Duke himself, Arthur said. What is your impression? Clara considered this with genuine care. Honest, she said finally. more honest than I expected, given everything. Honest men with significant power are either very good or very dangerous, Arthur said. Sometimes both at once. I know, Clara said. I have not decided which yet. Arthur nodded slowly. Then be careful until you have. What neither of them knew was that being careful was about to become considerably more difficult. The trouble arrived in the form of a story in a county where reputation was currency and gossip was the bank. By Thursday of that week, a version of events had begun circulating through Dunmore's drawing rooms that bore enough resemblance to the truth to be believable, and enough distortion to be damaging. The version said that Clara Bain had engineered the encounter on the Market Road herself, having known in advance that the Duke would be watching, that the helpfulness had been performance, that the physician's daughter had been cleverly positioning herself from the beginning. Nobody could say where the story had started. Clara heard it from Mrs. Hargrove, who delivered it with genuine distress and a cup of tea she had clearly brought specifically to soften the delivery. Clara sat with it for a long moment, feeling it settle over the morning like a change in weather. She was angry. She was also thinking that this story had come from someone who had been in that dining room and had understood exactly what the evening meant. The list of people that specific was not long. She didn't go to William. That was the first and clearest thing she decided. Going to him would look like exactly what the story accused her of. A woman managing her position, calculating her next move toward power. She would not do it. Whatever happened next would happen on honest ground, or not at all. What she did instead was go back to Dorothea. The old housekeeper answered the cottage door with the expression of someone who had been expecting this visit, and had put the kettle on accordingly. She let Clara in without ceremony, poured without asking, and sat down across from her with her sharp, unhurried eyes already doing their particular work. "You have heard it," Dorothea said. "All of it," Clara confirmed. "I want to know if he has heard it, too." "He has," Dorothea said. "Charles brought it to him yesterday evening." Clara looked at her hands around the cup. "And?" "He said nothing immediately," Dorothea said, "which with him means he is thinking rather than doubting. There is a difference, and it matters." "Does it matter enough?" Clara asked, and she meant it as a genuine question, not a performance of anxiety. Dorothea looked at her for a long moment. "He arranged a test because his judgment was broken," she said carefully. "What you are really asking is whether a broken thing, once mended, holds under pressure." "Yes," Clara said. "That is exactly what I am asking." Dorothea set her cup down. "Then you should know that this morning he sent Charles to find out where the story began. Not to protect himself. To protect you." Clara was very still. "He is already certain," Dorothea said simply. "The question is whether you are." Clara walked home through the cold with that sitting in her chest, warm and inconvenient and impossible to set aside. She thought about a man whose trust had been broken by someone close, who had built a careful test to find something real, and who, upon finding it, was now quietly working to defend it without telling her he was doing so. She had just reached her own gate when Philip Croft stepped out from the side of the road with the particular awkwardness of someone who has been waiting and has now lost confidence in the plan that seemed better indoors. "Miss Bain," he said. Clara stopped and looked at him with an expression that gave nothing away. "Mr. Croft." Philip had the grace to look uncomfortable. He was not, she decided, a naturally cruel person. He was a weak one, which was a different problem entirely. "My sister," he began, and then stopped and started again. "There are things being said that are not fair to you. I am aware, Clara said. I wanted you to know that I had no part in the telling of it, he said. The listening, yes. That is my fault. But not the telling. Clara looked at him steadily. Is there something you would like to do about it, Mr. Croft? Or did you come here simply to feel better about your own conscience? Philip opened his mouth and closed it again. Then he reached into his coat and produced a single folded paper, which he held out to her. This was taken from Mr. Pell's room at the inn, he said. Lavinia wanted it. I am returning it instead. Clara looked at the paper without taking it immediately. What is in it? Notes, Philip said. About you. About what Charles Pell observed and reported to the Duke after the road, after the dinner. After all of it. He paused. It is not what Lavinia thought it would be. It is not useful to her at all. Clara took the paper. She unfolded it. She read it. Charles Pell's handwriting was exactly as precise as she would have expected, small and organized and without flourish. The notes were brief, factual, and carried within their restraint a quality that she found unexpectedly moving. They recorded what she had done and said with the scrupulous accuracy of someone who had been genuinely paying attention. There was no embellishment. There was no editorial comment except for one line at the very bottom of the page, written in slightly different ink, as though added later. It read, "She is exactly what she appears to be. This is rarer than it should be." Clara refolded the paper carefully. She looked at Philip Croft, who was watching her with the expression of someone hoping he had done at least one thing right today. "Thank you," she said, and meant it without warmth, which was its own kind of honesty. She went inside and sat at the kitchen table for a long time, the paper in front of her, thinking about Charles Pell's final line and what it meant that a man as careful as William Arden had chosen someone as careful as Charles to observe for him. The following morning was sharp and bright, with the kind of winter morning that looks warmer through glass than it is. Clara was in the garden, pulling dead growth from her mother's herb beds, when Greaves, Lord Fenmore's butler, appeared at the garden gate with the composed expression of a man accustomed to delivering unexpected things to unprepared people. He carried a note sealed with the Merrith crest, handed it over without drama, and waited. Clara broke the seal and read it, standing in the garden with soil on her gloves. William Arden was leaving Dunmore at the end of the week. The boundary matter was formally concluded. He would be returning to his principal estate in the north, and before he left, he was asking if Miss Bain would consent to a brief meeting, properly arranged at Harwick Hall, with Lady Fenmore present, that same afternoon. Clara read it twice. Then she told Greaves she would be there. She did not tell her mother immediately, which was a decision she regretted approximately 40 minutes later, when Francis Bain found the broken seal on the kitchen table and appeared in the doorway of Clara's room. "He is leaving," Francis said. "At the end of the week," Clara confirmed. Francis sat on the edge of the bed and folded her hands in her lap with the careful posture of a woman organizing her thoughts into their correct order before releasing them. "And what does he want to say before he goes?" "I do not know," Clara said honestly. "I expect I will find out this afternoon." Francis looked at her daughter for a long moment with the specific attention of a mother who has watched a child grow into a person and is still occasionally surprised by the result. "Are you frightened?" Francis asked. "No," Clara said. And then, more honestly, "I am uncertain, which is different." "Good," Francis said. "Frightened closes things. Uncertainty leaves them open." Harwick Hall received her at 3 o'clock with the same imposing entrance and the same Greaves, who led her not to the formal rooms, but to a smaller sitting room at the back of the house that looked out over the winter garden. Lady Fenmore was already there, seated near the window with needlework she was clearly using as an occupation rather than a genuine project, and she greeted Clara with warmth that asked no questions and made no assumptions. William arrived 3 minutes later. He had the look of a man who had spent the morning making decisions and had arrived at this room having made all of them. He sat across from her, Lady Fenmore pleasantly and deliberately absorbed in her needlework at the far end of the room, and looked at Clara with the directness that she had come to recognize as simply how he communicated when he was not managing a room full of people. "I know about the story," he said. "I know where it came from. I want you to know that I do not believe a word of it, and that it has not changed a single thing about what I observed on that road or at this table." "I know," Clara said. He looked slightly surprised. "You know, Charles Pell's notes were returned to him this morning," she said, "by a route I suspect neither of you anticipated." She paused. "I read them before they were returned. I hope that is not objectionable." Something moved through his expression that was not quite amusement, and not quite relief, but contained elements of both. "What did you think of them?" "I thought Mr. Pell is an exceptionally precise observer," Clara said, "and I thought his final note was the kindest thing anyone has written about me, without intending for me to read it." William was quiet for a moment. Outside, the winter garden sat pale and still in the afternoon light, bare branches and frozen ground, and the particular beauty of things that have shed everything unnecessary. "I am returning north in 4 days," he said. "My estates require my presence, and I have delayed longer than I should have." "I understand," Clara said. "I do not want to leave without asking you something," he said, "and I want to ask it plainly, without arrangement or performance, because I think you are someone who prefers plain things." "I do," Clara said. He looked at her steadily. "I would like to write to you, and I would like, with your father's permission, to return to Dunmore in the spring. Not for boundary disputes or any administrative pretense, simply to continue what began on a muddy road with a bundle of firewood." Clara sat with that for a moment. She thought about her father's warning, and everything. "You may write," she said, "and I will reply. Whether the spring visit follows will depend on the quality of the correspondence." His expression shifted completely. It was the same brief rearranging she had seen at dinner, the smile that changed his face, but this time it stayed a moment longer. "Then I will write carefully," he said. "You should," Clara said. "I have high standards." Lady Fenmore, who had clearly been listening from behind her needlework the entire time, made a small sound that was unmistakably a suppressed laugh, and then composed herself immediately. The meeting lasted another 20 minutes. They talked about ordinary things: books, the county, her father's work, the difference between northern and southern winters, and the conversation had the quality of two people who have established something real and are now discovering what it feels like to simply exist inside it, without urgency. When Clara left Harwick Hall and walked back through the cold afternoon toward Ferrers Lane, she was thinking about spring in a way she hadn't thought about spring in a long time. What she didn't know, and would not discover until the first letter arrived 10 days later, was that Charles Pell had written 3 lines at the bottom of that letter in his own hand, below William's signature, without permission or apology. It read, "For the record, I told him on the first day. He took longer than necessary to agree with me. I hope you will be patient with his pace. He is worth it." Clara read those 3 lines 4 times. Then she sat down and wrote the longest reply she had written to anyone in years. Lavinia Croft left Dunmore for her family's southern property before the month was out, quietly and without announcement. Philip was not seen at the inn again. The story that had circulated dissolved the way invented stories always dissolve when the people at its center refused to perform the damage it was designed to cause. And on a muddy market road that nobody was paying attention to anymore, the place where a bundle of firewood had fallen and one young woman had stopped while everyone else walked past, the ground had long since dried and there was nothing left to see. But some things do not need to be seen to be permanent. Some things land in the right place at the right moment and hold there long after the mud has dried and the crowd has thinned and the road has gone quiet. Clara Bain had stopped for a stranger with a heavy load and no expectation of anything in return. That, in the end, was the only thing that had ever needed to happen. Now tell me honestly, if you had been walking that road the morning the firewood fell, would you have stopped or kept going? And now that you have seen what that single choice set in motion, do you think Clara handled Lavinia the right way, or should she have done something more? Drop your thoughts in the comments and tell me which part of the world you are watching from. If this story stayed with you, subscribe, because the next one will pull even harder. I will be reading every single comment to see who saw the twists coming.